Welcome to Hedge Fund Tips with Tom Hayes. I'm Tom Hayes, and this is your 183rd video cast, 173rd podcast for the week ending April 20th, 2023. Welcome. We're quickly going to go through the media hits, and then we've got quite a lot of Ask Me Anything questions this week, some great questions. So we'll get to that as well, and top positions, etc. First and foremost, I just came back from the Fox building on 6th Avenue. I was in studio with Liz Claman, which was really exciting. And I love going in studio because you meet tremendous people. On the way in, the gentleman who was on before me, Patrick McGinnis, runs Impossible Food. So I was talking to him about the burgers, and they're just getting better and better all the time. And then after me was the CEO of Tilray. This is April 20th. 420 is a big thing for that industry. Erwin Simon was there. And then as I was walking out by security, I had to do a double take. It was Rupert Murdoch. No joke, Rupert Murdoch. Yes, the guy who founded News Corp and Fox Business and all of it. He was there with walking through with his two security guards. He seemed in good spirits, so I guess it was a decent week for him. And then I ran into Kevin Mann, a friend of mine who runs Henyon and Walsh, $6 billion assets under management. He's going to come out and play golf and take some money from me on the course. And then I got to talk with Luke Rabari, who joined me on set with Liz Claman. You can see here, he runs Equity Armor. He runs a stock and vol fund. So it's just tremendous going in and doing it live in studio. There's nothing like it. So I want to thank Catherine Myers for having me on, Jake Mack, and of course, Liz Claman. There's nothing like being in person in studio with Liz. I really enjoyed that. We're going to play this segment right now just to get through the overview on markets, earnings, all the up-to-date information, outlook, couple picks, etc., so that we can get to more of the two-way conversation, Ask Me Anything questions at the end, because I'm getting feedback that that's really where a lot of the value has been derived. So listen in.
The bank crisis fear still hanging around like a bad house guest. A new Bank of America fund manager survey is hitting the most bearish levels of the year. Managers positioning for, I don't know, I guess you could call it the financial apocalypse by keeping their cash levels elevated and the highest bond allocation since March of 2009. And I know most of you remember that was the market bottom during the financial crisis. Should you follow the position for the apocalypse or a bull market? Let's get right to the floor show. Joining me now in studio, Equity Armor Investment CEO Luke Rabari and Great Hill Capital Chairman Tom Hayes. Tom, sometimes extreme bearishness signals that the turnaround's already begun and maybe some of these fund managers are late. But the X factor is the vapor trail that this bank crisis has left behind. I'm talking the most recent one in March. Where are you compared to the fund managers in your bullish bearish scenario?
Well, Liz, the secret to happiness is low expectations, and that's exactly what we had coming into the earnings season. Earnings were expected to drop 6.3%, and what we've seen already from 16% of the S&P reporting is that 78% beat, and they're beating on average by 5%, despite some of the earnings that you saw from Tesla, et cetera, some of the one-offs. Mm-hmm. So we remain constructive here. Not only are managers the most overweight bonds relative to stocks since 2009, they have the lowest growth expectations, they're the most pessimistic, and the most pessimistic towards real estate.
And you're saying that's a contrarian indicator right now.
Absolutely. You know, markets don't bottom when everyone's overweight cash and bonds. They don't top. They top when everyone is overweight equities, and they're overweight equities with leverage, and there are no marginal buyers. So when everyone's in cash, the pain trade is higher, and that's why we're climbing this wall of worry.
I don't know. Luke has a look on his face like, Tom, let me get in here. I'm sensing a little bit more bearishness, or at least concern.
Yeah, I've got a lot of concern about a lot of stuff. But to what Tom says, we are staying invested. But as volatility gets lower to these levels, we put more volatility on. And as stocks are going higher, we're lowering our stock exposure. We're selling some calls against our positions. We think the good times have kind of been over. And there's a couple of worrying things. Number one, the S&P and the NASDAQ. The NASDAQ is up 20% for the year. The S&P is up 7 or 8. the S&P is made up 50% NASDAQ stocks. So over 50% of the S&P is NASDAQ stocks.
And haven't the leadership names been kind
all
of the same? Microsoft,
all
the, Apple,
right.
who
all
else?
All the same. All the same. And the interesting thing about them is that the ones that have the biggest balance sheets, the strongest balance sheets, are the ones that have done well. Even in the energy sector, look at Exxon compared to some of the other companies. Microsoft, Google, Apple, although Meta was really beaten up, they have a big balance sheet. So we think people are kind of, and they're laying off people. They're not laying off people because they're expecting a lot of business. So even if the market doesn't crash, then they have to ramp up. There's going to take some time for that. And by the way, 2% inflation. I mean,
so
when that
away.
Happens, I'll be under 200 pounds again. That is not happening. My personal inflation rate is easily over 10%. This 5% stuff is, I wish it was 5% for me, but it is not.
Tom, I think Luke's right. You got to know what you're investing in.
Yeah.
I'm in the S&P 500. It's very diverse. It is.
Yeah.
But there is a heavy weight to tech.
Yeah.
When you look at the Russell 2000, for everybody out there who says, oh, my God, I absolutely love the small and mid caps, 16% of the Russell 2000 is made up of banks.
Yeah.
And not gigantic ones. And if you look at what the Russell has done, since, I don't know, the recent high, which may have been around February, we're looking at a one-week chart now, but you can see the big drop-off, and that was before the financial crisis, the mini-crisis or the mini-panic crisis that they're talking about. I don't know, can we put up since February? So there it is. You can see where we were. That was a two-handle. 2007 was where the Russell stood. We're at 1785 right now.
Yeah.
So let's just say you remain bullish and you're saying, Liz, so what?
Right.
Where do you love to salt in some of the cash at the moment?
It's a barbell. So we own Amazon, we own Alphabet, we own some of the bellwethers that that have been beaten down, and they still haven't recovered nearly a lot. We also like the ones with a massive margin of safety, and I know Luke's going to give me a hard time over this one. Not all REITs are created equal. So we like distress and dislocation, but it's got to be the highest quality. We actually, during the mini crisis last month, we put on two trades to play the mini crisis. We didn't buy regional banks. We bought Bank of America and we bought Vornado. Commercial real estate is the most hated sector in the business right now. Why are we considering
it? Well, nobody's going back.
No one's going back.
They're 20% vacant.
To the B and C properties. We think this is like the mall crisis of 4 to 5 years ago where we lost all the B and C properties, and Simon Property did very well. They have the Apple, they have the Lululemon.
Right. B and C is business to consumer.
B and C is the lower level properties. So with Vornado, you've got Madison Avenue, Park Avenue, Fifth Avenue, Sixth Avenue, like this. The best buildings in the best city in the world. And the stock, despite revenues being down 5% since pre-pandemic, cash flow down 10%, the stock is down 75%. It's trading at a 40% discount to book. The worst case scenario is priced in. It will get worse, but as the labor market loosens, more and more people are coming back to the office because they're nervous about getting laid off.
Okay, so if Tom's got his barbell approach, let me just say that I was scrutinizing this Bank of America fund manager survey, and they had the most heavily weighted long short trades that fund managers are in right now. The first one was long tech, short the banks. But the contrarian one is long the banks and short bonds. Are you anywhere in that alchemy?
We also run a little bit of a barbell, but right now we have some of the same names that he's talking about. The other side, where we want to take risk and get some returns, we're doing through some structured products, taking two or three names. Last time I was here, we talked about NVIDIA. Mm-hmm. Now, that's gotten a lot harder because since the last time, I think it's up $80. Makes
it
a little harder.
But
looking at some opportunities there. But again, I'm being really cautious because what I'm worried about are some of these REITs, and I'm going to get killed for it, and some of these other agency funds. You know, some of the REITs have put up gates. Everything's fine. Everything's fine, except we're only going to give you a little bit of your money back. If everything is fine, why are gates up?
Yep.
Why can't you sell
redemptions,
the properties that you have at the same prices or lower, right? And I think some of these funds have promised maybe around 5 or 6%. They target it, and then they say, we're going to have some upside. But, you know, one-year CD's paying 5%.
Well, that's also an issue, too. Great to see you both in studio. Be still my heart, my traders. Tom and Luke, always a pleasure.
And we're back. So moving right along, I'd like to thank Safrina Nasution, And Sifia is the producer over at CNBC Indonesia for having me on Tuesday morning, which was 4:30 p.m. their time, 5:30 a.m. our time. I get an extra hour break because it's daylight savings. Usually it's 4:30 a.m. and then you're up at 3:30. So that was tremendous. Now, this was an important segment because it was all about de-dollarization. And we had an Ask Me Anything question on that a week or two ago. And I, you know, we were running low on time and I just quipped, you know, that's clickbait by Cassandras to sell books and fear and all that stuff. And that's kind of true. But in this segment, which we're not going to have time to go through right now, but please listen on your own, we go through all the reasons why there is no next reserve currency anytime soon. And I think when you look through the argument and the conditions that would be required for another currency to take the place of the US dollar, there just isn't anyone in contention. So take a listen to that. Now, do not conflate the dollar weakening with losing reserve currency status, and do not conflate King Dollar with thinking that the dollar is going to be strong. We think that the dollar is going to trend lower in fits and starts over the next foreseeable future. That's going to help emerging markets, etc. But the discussion about reserve currency is a completely different discussion, and that's really not a discussion that's on the table at this moment. Also, want to thank Taylor Clothier, Dave Briggs, and Shauna Smith for having me in studio at Yahoo. That was a phenomenal time. We're going to go into this clip too. There's some of the same concepts as the Fox, but it goes into a little bit more detail about the outlook on this pocket of real estate. So take a listen in here.
On to Gaines, we want to bring in Tom Hayes, a Great Hill Capital chairman and managing member. Tom, it's great to see you here. So certainly one of the big headlines this week has been the slew of earnings reports that we've gotten so far. Less than 10% of the S&P has reported. What's your assessment, your takeaway from the results that we've seen?
Well, as we know, Dave, the secret to happiness in life is low expectations, and the same is certainly true with earnings. We came into earnings season very low expectations, negative 6.3%, so companies can just step over that bar. We've had 10%, just over 10%, 53 of the 500 components report earnings, and they're beating. 83% of the companies have beat earnings estimates by, on average, over 6%. So we were expecting negative 6%. We're getting plus 6% so far. We're also beating on revenues, plus 62% beat on revenues. Average beat was about 5% on the top line. So with the expectations so low, I think there's some upside here.
Did you address that to me? Because I've been setting the bar low my entire career.
It's my secret.
I caught that, right?
I caught that too. I didn't know if there was a backstory that I wasn't aware of.
I think so.
Last time I was on, we joked about that. And
it is the story of my entire career thus
far. Just
laid
it out there.
Set the bar low,
everyone.
You can leap over it easily. Yeah. But I've also noticed in some of these earnings calls, perhaps some analysts are suggesting that CEOs are sandbagging a bit in these calls, saying, well, we're starting to see some softer numbers come in right up at the end. Are you seeing sandbagging as well?
Well, that's the number one job of a CEO, right? You know, set expectations low, beat expectations. I think the market did it for the CEOs this quarter. They're being cautious into the second half, but I think we're going to see continued beats. And the thing is, you know, everyone is really looking for more downturn in the market. We're seeing it in positioning. We're seeing it in everything else.
Why? Why is everyone looking for that downturn? Why is everyone asking about a recession? There's nothing indicating one.
Yeah, well, you know, it's been the tightening cycle. It's been aggressive. People are saying, well, the lagged effect, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, you still had that huge increase in money supply. You still had a 40% increase in money supply over. That takes a long time to work through the system. And if you look through to next year, and the market's going to start to discount, just like we discounted the bad news that we're seeing kind of this year, last year in the market down 27%, we're going to start to. We're moving up on halfway through the year here in the next couple of months. Market's going to start to look through 2024 earnings recovery, and that's why you're seeing some strength and some indecision. Even if we're nowhere near 248, which is estimates, even if we come down to 240, there's some upside here. And on a stock picker's basis, there's a lot to do.
So, Tom, the street is clearly, from your perspective, too bearish. If you shouldn't be positioned, how it seems like traders have gone overweight bonds here, at least lately, and that was in the latest Bank of America fund manager survey, how should then investors be positioned for potentially that pop?
Well, look, you know, the stock market never tops when people are overweight cash and bonds. The stock market tops when people are overweight stocks. stocks on margin and there are no marginal buyers left. You've got growth expectations at the lowest rate since the 2009 lows, March 2009. People are more pessimistic than when the economy was shut down in March of 2020 and we didn't know if we were getting a vaccine. And you're also seeing they're taking less risk than they've ever taken all the way back to 2009. And pessimism toward the real estate sector is worse at the levels of March of 2009. You can't give real estate away. Now, looking back with 2020 hindsight, would you have wanted to be a buyer of residential real estate where all the problems were in 2009? Yes. Is this the time to be residential real estate? I don't know. But I can say we are seeing some opportunity in these beat-down REITs and the beat-down REIT sector, which no one wants. You can't give them away, and that's what we do. We like to buy things that are in distress that have high quality.
And in that sector, you do have a pick, and it is VNO, Vornado. Tell us why.
Well, this one you literally can't give away. The problem is it's been packaged in with all of these B and C class. So if you think about the mall problem 2, 3, 4 years ago, everyone said all these B and C malls are going to go out of business. And guess what? They were absolutely right. But the A malls like Simon Property Group, they consolidated. They're busier than ever. They've got Lululemon. They've got Apple. Everyone's excited. I think the same is going to be true with commercial real estate. As the labor market loosens, more and more people are going back to the office. And when you look at Vornado, you've got the greatest buildings in the greatest city in the world. If demand for those fall in half, we have a lot more to worry about than commercial real estate. This is run by the best operator in the business, Steve Roth, obviously, and his proxies. But there's something to do here. And I just like to burden myself with the facts. So let's look at the facts. Since 2019, pre-pandemic, revenues are down about 5%. Funds from operation are down about 9%. The occupancy rate is down about 0.9% for the New York City properties. Like I said, Fifth Avenue, Madison Avenue, Park Avenue, Penn Station, the new developments, et cetera. But the stock is down 75%. And those divergences are where money's made.
But what about the leases, though, that are going to expire over the next year or two? That's a big concern there. What exactly happens to these buildings and some of the conversion that's already taken place with those empty office buildings?
Yeah, well, Steve Roth, look, if they didn't take them out on a stretcher during the great financial crisis, they're not going to take them out on a stretcher right now. They have been selling off buildings and raising cash over the last 48 months. So they're in a good position to take advantage of the distress. But the demand, like you saw at the malls, for the highest quality properties, it's always going to be there from someone. And it's already priced in. We lost 16% book value per share since 2019. The stock is trading at a 40% discount to book if the entire thing was liquidated.
But the 10-city average on office occupancy, return to office, doesn't move, man. It is plateaued right at 48.49%.
Yeah.
It doesn't budge.
Yeah, because the labor, and by the way, that's in aggregate, okay, but at the highest quality buildings. So where Vornado's positioned, I think, no matter what, and as the labor market loosens, which we're starting to see because of all the tightening, people want to get FaceTime, they want to go to work. You know, I've talked anecdotally to people that are laying people off, and candidly, the easiest ones are the ones that are working remotely, the ones that are in with the team and that are in the office. And as people get a little bit nervous about, you know, potentially losing their job as they see people getting laid off, they're going to want to be in the office. And I think you're going to see that collaboration and you're going to see more and more people move back in. But to your point, we did lose a lot of malls during that mall cycle, but we didn't lose the best. And when we talk about Vornado, when we talk about Steve Roth, we're very, very interested.
We like your
By
conviction.
The way,
courageous
people
call.
People are scared about cutting the dividend. They already cut the dividend 43%. So at this stage, you're still getting a 10% yield at these levels. There's room to cut more if they have to. I don't think they're going to because they recently cut in the last 75 days. I think there's opportunity for upside here. It's for, not for
we'll
the faint of heart.
It.
Little volatility, but
no
it's
doubt.
An opportunity.
We yeah. like your conviction. Tom Hayes, good to see you, sir. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
All right, just kidding.
And we're back. So thanks for that. And Jacob Sonnenschein, want to thank him for putting me in his Barron's article this week. You definitely want to check that out here. You can click and go right to the Barron's website. It was about margins. And I was basically saying, you know, no one cares about current year earnings. That's kind of yesterday's news. It's priced in. The key thing is how close to reality is $245, $250 for 2024, because as we're now almost through April, the market's going to start to look forward in May and June to 2024, because 2023 becomes a rearview mirror. Remember, the market's a discounting mechanism. So it was nice of him. He kind of had a bearish tilt in his article, and like every good journalist, like the ones who are good journalists. He got the other side, which ours is more constructive. And I thought it was a great article. So good job, Jacob. And thanks for having me on. Also want to thank Bansari Kamdar, Tatiana Butzar, Menyaz, Yasmin for including me in their article on Reuters. And then finally, this is over the weekend. I took the girls to play nine holes, so they're getting into it. And as you can see, they were happy. And as we got, you know, way out past away from the clubhouse, they got to tool around a little bit under close supervision, of course. And they had a blast. So they'll probably have a lower handicap than I do in no time. Although I'm making improvements thanks to that lesson. Andy Plummer, if you guys are in Miami, go see Andy Plummer. Really extremely valuable half day or so, or a little more than that, that I spent with him. And he got, you know, three key things that I've been focused on that have been working well. Then, of course, we topped it off with some hibachi, and that's Mimi catching flying zucchini. And as you can see, it's not going well. This one's probably is the one that hit her in the forehead. I, on the other hand, did catch my first flying zucchini. So there you go. All right. Some of the indicators we look at, just want to show you this. I mean, today was like a down day. Everyone's pessimistic all of a sudden. Yesterday, people were optimistic. It's amazing how quickly, you know, opinion follows trend. It's like the same people who were on yesterday with a bullish story are the same people on today that are worried and despondent. It's comical. You'll see our message is pretty consistent based on the facts. So, you know, what you're seeing here with the VIX is the same normal pattern, a heart attack, an aftershock, and a downtrend, a heart attack, an aftershock, and a downtrend, heart attack, aftershock, downtrend, heart attack, aftershock, downtrend. So this pattern continues to repeat, and we believe this time will be similar. A couple others I want to show you. The skew, it's not yet at the levels where I would be concerned. We're nowhere near a top where people are buying two standard deviation out insurance. A little bit, but not much. The McClellan summation index, it's coming off of the, was knocked out on the floor, starting to work its way back up again. And that's what it does after bottoms, not near tops. Same thing with the NASI, which is the NASDAQ version of that. Same type thing down here. You want to be buyer, not seller. Bullish percent S&P 500, that's picking up, which is a good thing, showing some follow through. And I think that's most of them. The National Association of Active Investment Managers. So managers got a little bit more exposure this week, but they're not over their skis by any stretch of the imagination yet. Opinion will follow trend. More than McClellan, we covered that. This is real estate stocks above their 200 exponential moving average. You can see it's completely left for dead here, as it was in 2020, as it was in 2018, as it was at the beginning of 2019 and the end of 2016 and early and late 2015. All of those times were bottoms. This is completely left for dead, and that's why we keep talking about one idea in the space where we think that the margin of safety is there. It's pricing in close to the worst, if not the worst case scenario. So while the the way stocks work and the stock market works, it always discounts 6 to 9 months ahead. So there's probably going to be more pain. So commercial real estate stocks, the ones that are high quality, the B and C properties, I wouldn't touch with a 10-foot pole, just like I wouldn't touch them 4 or 5 years ago when you were having the mall debacle. And the A properties like Simon Property excelled. The B and C, some of them got wiped out. I think the same is going to be the case with commercial real estate. The A properties like Vornado are going to do even better over time. And the B and C, some of them are going to get wiped out. Some of them are going to get converted, etc. But there's opportunity there, and we love dislocation as long as we're up the quality food chain in the face of that, and that's what we've always done, whether China, whether banks, whether energy stocks, and now commercial real estate. So NASDAQ high low, you can see NASDAQ just getting off the mat after multitude heart attack here over 6 months, and then same thing with this 1% EMA, which we covered last week. Same exact story. heart attack, roll back over, fake everyone out, and then take off. Heart attack, roll back over, fake everyone out, and then take off for multi-years. Heart attack, same story. Heart attack, roll over, fake everyone out, and then take off. And I think we're there. And, we've covered the divergence last week. Go through last week. We spent a lot of time on the divergence between the soft numbers coming in, what has been priced in 6 to 12 months anticipating this, and kind of threading that needle as the market starts to look forward to 2024 and how we've done a lot of correction in time. We did price last year. We've done time. The stock market has made no progress in now over 24 months. And usually if the lows have held as long as they have, which is now going on 6 months, which was October when we said, if you're not buying stocks here, you're in the wrong business. Or what I actually said was, if we're not buying stocks today, what the hell are we doing? And sure enough, the market's now up 17%. S&P 500, the 3% more, and we're technically out of a bear market. And we're going to go through what happens when you're out of a bear market, et cetera. So the equity put call ratio, 10-day moving average, this is a good one because like the VIX, you get the heart attacks at the bottom and then it just slowly works its way down and the market works its way up. So all of these things are in good stead. Now let's look at the top, some of our top weights historically here. And, it feels like, oh, Cooper Standard goes down every day. What is happening? But in reality, all it's doing is the normal thing that bottoming processes do, which is it's making higher lows and higher highs and higher lows. So you had the heart attack in May and June when we got involved. Then you had this huge rally. Then everyone doubted when it went back down to five. And then it, consolidated in price. Then you had the rally into January, February. Everyone got excited. Many people bought up at $17 or $18. Now you're consolidating back down. Maybe it goes back down to the 200-day. Who knows? Earnings are May 3rd. But I got to say, exactly what we said was going to happen is happening. We saw it last night with Tesla. And Tesla, by the way, is a client of Cooper Standard. They can't put their logo on their pitch book. But what's exciting is the big three were getting away with murder during COVID under the guise of the supply chain and some reality of the supply chain. Let's be fair. Now the supply chain is eased and they tried to keep only selling a limited supply of high margin products, i.e. F-150s, Escalades, that type of stuff, Suburbans, Tahoes, the whole story. And I said, you just wait. What's going to happen once the supply chain eases? Hyundai is going to say, you don't want to make cheap cars? We're going to flood the market. Kia is going to flood the market. Toyota is going to flood the market. Well, guess what? Everyone's been forced into this EV box by the government, and they've all invested huge amounts into that. And Tesla said, listen, I've got the margins. Your margin is my opportunity. Remember, that's how Bezos took over the world? Well, Musk is doing the exact same thing. And everyone's like, oh my God, the car companies are doing terrible. They have to discount cars. Look at the volume in the earnings report. His volumes are going up and he's cutting prices to get more share and more volume. What's going to happen is very simple. They're all going to start producing tons of cars, cutting prices. And guess what? That may not be good for Ford's earnings. That may not be good for GM's earnings. That may not be good for Stellantis. It may not be good for Tesla's earnings. It may not be good for Volkswagen's earnings. But the one thing you did see with Tesla was their revenues were up 24% year on year. Their car volumes were up. And we're going to see more and more car volumes. And all we care about with Cooper Standard is car volumes. And it just so happens that the government did something that benefits us, which is forced everyone into the EV world where we make increase 20% on every car because there are actually more parts for EVs that Cooper Standard sells to the new cars than ICEs, internal combustion engines. So I think it just gets better and better and the thesis plays out perfectly. Now, people are saying, oh, but people are pulling wholesale lines, floor lines and all that stuff. Those are predominantly from used car dealers. Used car dealers, in my view, are toast. I mean, yes, we saw a little bit of used car pricing strength last month, but I think they just don't have the financing situation. GM is offering incentives. Ford is offering incentives. Tesla's offering incentives. You're going to see more and more incentives. And when the average car on the road is 13 and a half years old, the oldest that it's ever been in history, and the incentives are there, in a 7% interest rate world, if they give you 0, 1, 2, 3%, and it's no longer selling at a premium to MSRP, and you've been waiting for 4 years because you couldn't get any supply. Every time you ordered a Bronco, you had to wait 24 months. Now they're available. Now they're below MSRP. Now you can get favorable financing terms from new car dealers, manufacturing dealer incentives. We're going to see the volumes. And I don't care what Ford's margins are. I don't own Ford. I don't care what GM's margins are. I don't own GM. I don't care what Tesla's margins are. I don't know. I am selling the pick and the axe to the gold rush, okay? Gold rush is everyone's trying to sell all these EVs. All I'm doing is selling the pick and the shovel to the speculators that are wondering which of these men are going to be left standing, you know, last man standing, so to speak, of all these people rushing and trying to undercut each other to gain share. And that game is going to go. All they're doing is helping us with Cooper Standard, giving us more volumes, giving us more sealing around the door, fuel delivery systems, cooling systems, et cetera, that we can sell all day long. So don't get mistaken, which the market does, or the algos do, or whatever, by auto parts dealers that are selling into O'Reilly, into Advanced Auto Parts, into the used car market. I think those guys are done. They've had a run. Don't get confused by GM margins contracting or Ford losing money or any of that stuff. All you care about is aggregate volumes. And we're going to talk about aggregate volumes. They're going up. They're well above average now. They're starting to recover. And that's all we need to see. New cars, incentives, volumes. And I want to play a little clip from Elon Musk this morning from his earnings call last night, just to get the clear picture out so everyone can be crystal clear on what to be focused on when you hear all the noise day to day.
Let's begin with Tesla, though, down sharply in the pre-market. These price cuts resulting in the company's lowest quarterly gross margin in about 2 years. On last night's call, Elon Musk did highlight that sales growth is still a top priority.
While we reduced prices considerably in early Q1, it's worth noting that our operating margin remains among the best in the industry. We've taken a view that pushing for higher volumes and a larger fleet is the right choice here, versus a lower volume and higher margin. It's better to ship a large number of cars at a lower margin and subsequently harvest that margin in the future as we perfect autonomy. This is an extremely important point.
Here you go. And we're back. So that's the story here. This is just going perfectly according to plan. Rally, consolidation. We'll have more rallies and more consolidations as we work our way back to $5 to $7 plus of earnings, and we put a fair market multiple. Now, Alibaba, you know, everyone's like, oh, it's going down. Look, it's doing exactly what it needs to do. There's no news. It doesn't report till probably mid-May. And here's what you got. You got your shoulder, your head, your shoulder, and you're going to work back up. And it always does these checkbacks just to fake everyone out. Because why? Because everyone bought at $120 after it rallied 100% off the bottom. Then they all puked it out. They got it just below 80. So everyone thought it was going back to 58. They all puked out here. Then they took them up and people bought back over 100. Now they're shaking them out. This is just normal market psychology. This happens over and over and over. It's back to just like the CPS maybe going back to the 200. I don't know if it has to go that far, but maybe it will. It doesn't really matter. They report on May 3rd, and I know the numbers are going to be good because I've seen the volumes. I focus on what's important. I ignore the noise, and I own the business. And that's the key, is as a business owner, not as someone that's worried about stock prices from day to day. Someone tweeted today, like, you know, if earnings are so good, why is the market going to? I was like, do you expect it to go up every single day? Like, you know, it's just not the way it works. It's life. I mean, you know, operas and movies and plays would not be interesting if there was no drama. It can't be sunny every day of the year. You know, just hang tight and don't get faked out by the rainy days, and it'll work its way through. Here's biotech. Okay, same exact thing. Bottomed in May, huge rally. Everyone got excited. It's above the 200-day moving average. honestly, who gives a you-know-what, okay? Then it was below the 200-day moving average. So it's corrected sideways in price, took out a lot of the Johnny-come-latelys. Now it's working its way back up. Oh, the 200-day moving average, you got up to that. It bounced off. It'll work its way through. We're nearing the end of the tightening cycle. We know what happened in 2016 to 2018 as that tightening cycle ended. It rebounded 135%. It's going to do the exact same situation. We'll be up triple digits off the bottom, and everyone will say, what happened? And what happened was they weren't patient, and they got caught up in all this day-to-day BS rather than focusing on the big picture, staying pat, knowing what you own, and building wealth over time and being patient. And that's the name of the game, and that's what you get paid for. Like I always say, they don't give you multi-baggers for free. You got to earn them, and that's what we try and communicate on these regular podcasts. So Bank of America Global Fund Manager Survey results covered a few of these things. Obviously, you can see it visually is very helpful. More overweight bonds than stocks, even in the pandemic lows and all the way back to the great financial crisis lows. These are periods, they don't come around often, where if you're a buyer, you can make a tremendous amount of money versus being a seller and puking in the hole. So a couple other things I wanted to cover here. By the way, thank you very much, Adam, for sending this. I know Adam likes to stay private, so I'm not going to, you know, say his name, but you know who you are, and I'm very grateful for the stuff that you send. Let's take a look here. 35% of fund managers expect the Fed to start an easing cycle in Q1 of 2024. So that's kind of interesting. Inflation expectations have collapsed to the lowest since March of 2009. So that's kind of a yesterday's news. The only one who hasn't got the memo is Jay Powell. Hopefully, you know, maybe he needs another meeting to do one more hike so he can pound his chest and say, I'm Paul Volcker. But there's zero purpose in doing that right now, but we'll see what happens. Sentiment, more bearish than the great financial crisis lows, the pandemic lows. And that's all you need to know. Were those times to buy or times to sell? Real estate pessimism is goes all the way back to 2008. This is an important part of our thesis with Vornado. And by the way, Vornado is trading back down to great financial crisis lows. Let me tell you, the situation was completely different in 2009. If he didn't get taken out on a stretcher then, it's not going to happen now. And they've been selling buildings to raise cash, so they're in a good position to take advantage of any further distress that we see in the private markets at the end of the year. We believe the public markets have priced in even more than what's happening, similar to how the banks did it when they were over-reserving in 2020. And we talked about CECL, and we talked about the reserve releases. The same is going to be true. Because you know, there are very few comps. There's one terrible comp in California, so everyone's extrapolating that for everywhere in the country. And so everyone says, well, based on rates and these terrible comps, that it's, you know, all these buildings are going to sell at a 40% discount. The best buildings in the world are going to sell at 40% discount. And guess what? Vornado's already trading at a 40% discount to book. It's already priced in. The worst case scenario, if every building was worth 40% less, that's what they're trading at right now. God forbid we get any good news. And I made the case on both of those shows, so I'm not going to repeat that part. What level of risk do you currently think you're taking? They're taking less risk than the pandemic lows and the great financial crisis lows, pari passu with the great financial crisis lows. So most underweight financials since May of 2020, that were the pandemic lows. The problem is you haven't gotten a big enough correction in some of the names that I would be willing to own where it could become a top three position. We did buy Alibaba and we did buy Vornado in the middle of the quote unquote mini crisis last month as our dislocation plays. But the banks haven't really served up a pound the chest, make it a 10% plus position. You know, that is really attractive to me. And I still don't want to play in the regionals. If I'm going to play the regionals, I'll just play it through a basket of small cap, get the upside without the downside, without as much downside risk on a discrete basis. Because all the regional banks are confident. So like if you get a big person pull and it gets out, then everyone pulls and they're toast. So investors are overweight bonds and underweight equities relative to history. So you can see bonds, staples, utilities, cash. These are not the conditions for a top in the market. These are conditions for a bottom in the market. This is what you see at bottoms in markets, not tops, when everyone is overweight in defensives and cash and underweight in equities the most underweight equities, REITs, tech, all the things that we're talking about here. Biggest tail risks, bank credit crunch and global recession. It's not going to happen with China. I mean, you saw today Citibank was on taking their GDP estimates for China from 5 to 6% because they knocked the cover off the ball this week. And we'll talk about that in the article of the week. So that's the story. Knocking on heaven's door, stock market and sentiment results. And this is what I'm pointing out. So maybe today it got back to this line or slightly below this line. I think we're still at 4,100 or something like that. Up 17% from the October lows, which is not much different than the June lows. So we've basically done nothing. Feels like watching paint dry, and that's exactly what's happened. And then you go back 2 years and nothing's happened there either. But this has created the opportunity for us to get more of our favorite positions, both in October, both in June, and most recently in middle of March, which was an incredible opportunity. So we're happy. You can read all about Bob Dylan there. As you can see from the featured chart above, we've come through the point of control. So the bulk of the volume by price is below current levels. This will act as support. So if you pull back down to 40-50, there should be some buyers come in and support that. This simply means there's less overhead supply to come in on the market as we press higher. We are now working on pushing through the neckline or inverse head and shoulders pattern, not dissimilar to Alibaba, by the way. Shoulder, head, shoulder, and then push through. And a measured move would take you from another 500. So you'd be at like 4,500 would be quote unquote the measured move, which I think is actually in the potentially in the cards for the next 6+ months. Very minority view, and maybe even higher would really take people for a loop. If you look back at that 1966 analog that we covered last month. By the way, you can find the original, because we were talking about it way before Ken Fisher. You can find our original post about that near the June lows, which is pretty interesting. Okay, we covered that. We covered earnings. You listened to that already. Here's the commitments of traders. This is the large speculators are the most short the S&P futures than they've been since 2011, which was the European debt crisis. 2015 was the high yield crisis and the pandemic lows. All you need to know is if you bought stocks during those periods, you made a lot of money. But no one wants to believe it. It's like this time is different, except it's never different. You know, fortunately, I've had the blessing of a career to have two once in 100-year events happen in the last decade with the Great Financial Crisis. Last time you saw that was 1932, and the pandemic, the last time you saw that was 1918. So like, you know, when these indicators wash out to certain levels, if you're not buying, you're just simply not cut out for the business. It's that simple. I mean, it's like when everything points to one direction and you can't stomach to sit through, you know, a few months or a year for things to play out and then double and triple your money, then just, you know, this is not the only way to make money. There's so many great ways to make money. Just accept you're not cut out for it and go build an incredible company and provide a lot of value for people and do great and lay off your cash to other people who are very good at doing this and understanding the different opportunities that dislocation creates and have the stomach to not only position you, but walk you through when you're, you know, not understanding and worried, et cetera, and go through these point by point and say, oh, that makes sense. Yes. Yeah. When things get that washed out, there's no marginal sellers left because everyone's in cash. The market is never going to look. Go talk to everyone, your friend. Ask them how many how much treasuries, money markets, or cash do you have? Do you have more cash? By the way, a good question. This is hysterical. If you go and ask 10 of your friends, do you have more cash and bonds than you did at the pandemic lows and the great financial crisis lows? And I'll bet the vast majority are going to say, I have about the same. I was really scared then. And, you know, I'm really worried now. And that's when you know it's the time to buy equities. And I'm not saying buy the S&P. I'm talking about discrete businesses that have come down to such a level where there's a big enough margin of safety that you can't miss. All you have to do in order for the return payment of a multi-bagger, double, triple, plus, is sit through the short-term volatility. If it goes lower and you have cash, buy more. As long as you know what you own, As long as it's a compounder of capital or has highest quality assets underlying it, the short-term price is immaterial because over time it will revert to that normalized value. And I'm not talking about marginal businesses and marginal companies that are more of gambles. I'm talking about high-quality franchises that are proven over time. Okay, so we covered all this, de-dollarization. Now let's go through some other factors, upward revisions. As a matter of fact, since the beginning of earnings season, not only have we beat more than expected, plus 5%, as I went over with Liz, versus negative 6.3 as expected. It's early in the game. Tech earnings are everything next week, so we got to pay attention to that. But actually, estimates have moved up a bit, which no one's really talking about. We'll see how that holds. And it's a little surprising to see them moving up this early. I would think in future quarters, but nonetheless, that's good news. The other thing that's very interesting, so percent, this is from Yordani via Seth Golden, hat tip over there. Percentage S&P companies with positive 3-month percent changes in forward revenues. This is recovering massively and quickly, similar to 2016 after you had that fake out, similar to 2002. Same thing with earnings, with positive 3-month percent changes in forward earnings, rebounding hard off those lows last year. And this is also consistent. So you don't see that. You don't see a recovery before a recession. It's still going down. And this is from Bloomberg Intelligence. Regime model implies the U.S. recession actually started in 2022. We've had these rolling recessions. If you look at some of the economic data, Philly Fed Index, etc., the S&P 500 historically performs after model lows led by small caps. We've just hit the model lows, and that implies that the recession started, and we know we had a technical recession in Q1 and Q2 of 2022, which we've been saying. So consumers will still have low debt service. That's disposable income to service their debt. Debt payments as a percentage of disposable income, that's the lowest going back to the 60s, actually. Company interest coverage is at multi-decade highs. So the bears say, oh, debt levels are high. Well, that's nominal. Who cares? How much EBITDA do they have to service the debt? And it's at record highs. Record highs. EBIT to interest expense on debt. This is since 1998. No period ever comes closer except after the deleveraging in 2009. By 2015, everyone had paid down their debt because they were so scared, or it got written down. But we're better than that. Even after all the deleveraging, we're better than that. So same thing with small cap, same thing with large cap. We're well above average, more coverage than ever. Everyone refinanced when rates were low. So they can go, as we talked about last week, as much as 10 years for most of these companies not having to worry about it. You say commercial real estate, it all comes due. It's going to be an exercise in extend and pretend. The banks don't want the properties. They won't know what to do with the properties. They're just going to extend and pretend until everything comes back, and it will come back. Returns following single negative years trend above average. So you can see in 2019, next year was up 29%. 2008, next year was up 23%. The 2000 to 2003 was 3 negative years. We're not in that situation. We're up some 7% this year. That was an aberration, by the way, and that was after a 20-year expansion. 1990 recession, then you were up 26% the next year. And 1981, by the way, very interesting comparison. We've covered a lot of 1981 and 1982. And then guess what? Next 2 years, 15% and 17%, so over 32%. Bear market ends up 20% off lows. What happens next? Well, we're up 17% or so on the S&P from the October lows. At 20%, the bear market is technically over. Doesn't guarantee anything, but you can see what happens. Very good things happen. Average is 162% after you come out of a bear market. Some are short, like the 66 analog was a 48% return. It lasted 25 months. Could be the case here. The 1960 was a 39% bull run. It lasted 13 months. That was the shortest. But most of them are a bit longer and a much higher return. The 82, which I think is very comparable when they may shift tactics, we've covered 100 times, 229% over the next 60 months. I think that would be something in the line of a possibility as we move forward based on very similar demographics in the early 80s. We have the millennials now, 80-some million people. We had the boomers then, housing formation. Listen, that was 40 years ago. They're now late 60s, early 70s, and we've got the millennials early 30s. So I think the demand, the spend demand, this is probably the most likely scenario, and that's what we're positioned for. New car sales accelerating above average units. This is all we care about is units. We don't care if they sell them for $5. As long as they push the units out, they take the loss. We have the volume, and that's the name of the game. So inflation, we covered this ad infinitum. City surprise index, this is done. Global surprise index, done. The Coppock curve, it's a technical indicator. You can just look at this. It works, and it happens at the beginning after you have these big drawdowns like we had last year, 2009, 2002, then early mid-90s, 94, 95, which is also an interesting comp. This is the early 90s recession, 91. That was the S&L crisis, commercial real estate crisis, and just straight up after that, as well as 87, and then straight up. Chronic fear, pulling money, and markets grinding higher, the wall of worry. Are you more likely to increase or decrease your equity exposure over the coming days and weeks? Here's what's interesting. The top of the market, 80% of people right here, the end of 2021 going into 22, 80% of people planned on increasing their equity exposure. Bottom of the market, 26 people plan on increasing their equity exposure. Opinion follows trend. It's just hysterical. Where do you see the S&P 500 at the end of the year? 54% see it at 3,500. It tells you everything you need to know. Even if there were all the fundamental reasons to go to 3,500 by the end of the year, there's no way in hell it's going to be there because that's how everyone's positioned. It's just not the way the market works. Market is designed to cause the most amount of pain to the most amount of people at any one point in time. And right now, everyone has cash thinking they're going to be able to buy back at 3,700 or 3,500. And it's simply not going to happen. What's going to happen is they're going to be forced to buy up at new highs, and then the market's going to correct. And that's the way it works every single time. And this time will be no different. Rents rolling over, that's the biggest component of CPI. We're going to see it. We saw it already this month. It's going to continue. Only one who hasn't got the memo is Powell. Retail sales, this is from a reporter at Bloomberg, Robert Burgess. Lots of talk about how the U.S. consumer is cracking, but total retail sales at some $692 billion are about $100 billion above the pre-pandemic trend line. That's all you need to know. People can't figure out, like, oh, we're going to get killed by the lagged effect. Well, yes, there is truth to that. But there's no way you're working off. They pumped 40%. They increased money supply by 40% in 24 months. You know, taking a couple $100 billion off the balance sheet and raising rates is not going to dissolve that overnight. And that's completely evidenced by what you're seeing. You know, I was talking to the Impossible Foods CEO. He's like, I'm on first class. I'm at restaurants. Everything's packed. I don't see it. Exactly. Okay. And that's the story. This is from Seth Golden. I really like this chart. It's from the Federal Reserve. And he said, commercial real estate is not, I repeat, not the same size problem it was 30 years ago. That's in the early 90s recession. Commercial real estate mortgages are way below the percentage of outstanding total mortgages than when the commercial real estate recession hit in 1990. I love this line. Hard to crash land jumping out the basement window. So, yeah, here's the difference, ladies and gentlemen. It was commercial real estate was 24% of mortgages outstanding in 1988, 1989, and it took till 1995 to work it off. They did all the extend and pretend, and the special facility with the government, kind of like TALF was in the post-Great Financial Crisis. We're nowhere near there. We're nowhere near 60%. We're at 40% and change, and that's more in line with the long-term, below the long-term average. Actually, let me just see this. Hold on for a second. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Mortgage percent commercial real estate held at U.S. banks and percent of mortgages outstanding. Okay. So, yeah. So this one is commercial real estate mortgage. U.S. Bank. Okay, that one's less relevant. Yeah, percent of mortgages outstanding. And you can see here, going all the way back to 1951, it's at the lower end of the scale, below average for sure. Ex-U.S. China, the China data blows past forecast. Citi China Economic Surprise Index at 17-year high, going all the way back to 2006. If you remember the boom from 2002 to 2007, that's all you need to know. Here are this week's numbers. The GDP came in at 4.5% year on year, way better than the last print at 2.9 and, well above the estimate of 4.0. The industrial production came in better than expected. Retail sales crushed it 10.6% versus 3.5 last and, 7.4 estimated. Retail sales year on year. That was year over year. China retail sales, 5.76. Chinese unemployment rate, better than expected, 5.3 versus 5.5. And what were they spending on? Jewelry, 37.4%. Restaurants, 26.3%. Clothing, 17.7%. Medicine, 11.7%. And automobiles, up 11.5%. And Cooper also sells into that market, just FYI. Dollar weakening, that's good for emerging markets and ex-US. It's also good for tech because they sell, you know, 50% of their revenues come from abroad. That's the biggest weight in the S&P 500. And you can see the last four bear markets, 67, 85 peak. And I went through it in the CNBC interview. You can go through it there. Regime change, outperformance by the US goes for periods of years. Then you get outperformance by ex-US. And we're just starting that. I think we've got another 2002 to 2007, which is why we have such a heavy weight in emerging markets, represented by Alibaba, which is the highest quality in a massive, in the most dislocated part of the world, which is China, the highest quality business that gives us a lot of optionality, outs, as they say in poker, for my fellow poker players, a Texas Hold'em. And this game is just beginning. So just have patience. When you get the day to day, it's down a dollar, it's up $2. Yay. Wow, yay, wow. This is all just noise until it takes off. So just hang in there. PEs are two standard deviations below the average for ex-US, and on and on. So that's the story. Retail investors are still scared, only 27% bullish. That's good conditions. Fear and greed is pushing higher. Sentiment is improving. And the National Association of Active Investment Managers, we covered. S&P earnings estimates, they're basically flat for 2023 and 2024 over the last 60 days. The top 30 weights down 16 basis points and 24 basis points. That's just noise. We'll know at the end of next week what the tech earnings came in. The one that's gotten hit is the Russell earnings, down 7.83 and 4.78. And what is that comprised of? Energy stocks, which we told you at the end of last year when everyone was telling you to buy them. On TV every day, we're saying not for us. Well, this is all energy and small banks. So that's all you need to know. Not both of which have been don't touch. And that's reflected. But I do think there's going to be a rebound in banks. That's a safe way to play it because you can have the upside without the discrete downside on a company by company basis. Economic data. You know, enough of this is actually given the Fed cover. Continuing claims were higher than expected. Initial jobless claims higher than expected. So if they want to pause, they can. If they want to make a mistake, they can add another 25 basis points. The market can probably digest it at this point. It's kind of priced in, but I think it's a mistake and it'll just cost them more easing later. Estimates are still holding up for 2024. No one wants to acknowledge it. They keep saying they've got to come down. They got to come down and they just don't. 247. It's been basically in that neighborhood for, you know, over a quarter now. All right, let's get to the questions. Ask me anything. And okay, let's see here. All right, this is from Ronan Bitton. Hi, Thomas. I follow your videos and I'm really satisfied. I'm glad you're satisfied. I invested in the Baba company after the decline in the stock price, was looking for someone on the net who could confirm my choice, and that's how I came to you. My name is Ronan, and I'm from Israel. Well, welcome from Israel, and I would like to receive your opinion regarding two shares, SIG and SLG and CHS. Okay, SLG is a commercial property REIT. I like the thesis. Why I wouldn't touch SLG is because they have way more B quality properties than Vornado does in New York, and B and C are going to be toast. I don't think they're going to be toast, but I just don't want to play that game, because if it gets worse than you expect, you want to be in the highest quality and just wait it out. Whereas SLG, you can get stopped out. That's an easy one. The other one is CHS. I don't know what that is. Let's see. Chico's. Okay. This is where money goes to die. So let's just see if anything's improved. Chico's. This has been luring value investors for decades, and it never works. It's kind of a low-quality female retailer. It's an interesting thought from the standpoint of a pandemic recovery. You know, they were probably left for dead during the COVID, and now they're starting to recover a little bit. Yeah, I mean, it does look like they're starting to recover. And it is in that kind of consumer discretionary basket we've been talking about that no one wants to touch. It's interesting. It's like Buffett can give Goldman Sachs $5 billion during the middle of the financial crisis after 5 minutes of quote-unquote due diligence, i.e. not no due diligence, because he's followed the business for 30 years. This is a business that I just know is a chronic disappointer for 30 years. I'm just going to pass. It's not to say it won't go to 20 bucks or whatever. It's just, I know enough. I'm okay with errors of omission, like you just miss it. But commission, when I just know it tends to be a low quality cyclical business over time, just a pass. But just go a little higher up the food chain. I think your thinking is right, Ronan. I think you're right there. I think you're just trying to squeeze a little too much juice out of the lemon. Go for the ones that have the juice and have enough margin of safety, but you can still get a double or triple, and I think you'll be a lot better off. Moving right along, let's see here. All right. Brian, first name only. Longtime listener, love your podcast. Thank you for sharing your opinions and insight into your process. I was looking for your opinion on Novartis. The stock recently had a big move on the back of successful breast cancer drug trial. What do you think about the business here with the continued change towards a focus on innovative medicines and the spinoff of the genetics Sandoz business later this year? Also, if you're ever in Ireland, I'd love to pay you back for all the knowledge you've given me and the listeners by showing you some of our famous Lynx golf courses. That'll be the real test of your swing. Brian, at the pace I'm going, I might be ready for that sooner than later. And I'm going to take you, I'll probably take you up on that. You do know the last name is Hayes, so there's some Irish in me, and that'll be a lot of fun. NVS, let's take a look. I mean, yeah, it looks like it's breaking out here. I mean, it's definitely interesting. We have a ton of exposure to biotech through XBI and equivalents, so it's not a whole lot of room for discrete companies, but this is a good one, and I know I've covered it before on the Clayman Countdown a few times, and it's had a few great trades with it, but I think you're going to be okay with this one. I don't think it's going to shoot the lights out. When they do the spin, keep the spin, don't sell the spin, because the spin originally initially will sell down as institutions get out of it, but they tend to outperform over time. So definitely keep the spin. It's had a big move. So for me, this is one of those kind of hold forever businesses and don't think about it. It's a good quality business. I think there are better places where you're going to get more bang for your buck. But if you want to sleep at night, collect a decent dividend, looks like a 4% dividend, compound your capital slowly over time, good management, I think you're okay here. I think it's a decent business and a decent pick. So thanks for sending that in. Bob Johnson, your evergreen quality question submitter, Bob here. I have been reading up on Howard Mark's recent comments regarding the third sea change underway in markets. For those of your audience that are uninitiated, he believes we will enter a foreseeable future where interest rates will remain elevated, capital availability will be more constrained, and unsustainable or ill-conceived businesses that relied on cheap capital, cheap money, will mostly disappear from the marketplace. You often talk about certain stocks where price is dislocated from value and how they may return to pre-pandemic valuations. Have you and your team revamped and revised your IRRs for your holdings based on this? And do you have any other thoughts or perspectives on what Marx is stating? Thank you and keep up the great work. Well, listen, P.S. always sharing your podcast. Cheers, Jason. So, wait a second. How's your name Bob Johnson and you signed your email Jason? All right. Well, it is what it is. You can't make this stuff up. Anyway, look, asking a bond guy if the sun is coming out to tomorrow is probably not a good idea. I mean, Howard Marks is a fantastic, legendary investor. He's a fixed income investor. As a matter of fact, the gentleman I was on with today, Luke, he trades volatility. So by nature, if your inclination is to trade bonds or be a short investor or be a volatility trader, your worldview is generally consistently skeptical. And the odds are against you because the market goes up 70% of the time. So I think he's correct, but I think what we're missing is context, because we look at rates being high relative to recent history and getting stuck in the recency bias. But the entire bull run of the 90s and the tech in the late 90s was with a Fed funds rate above 6%, and we're at 4.75. So there are so many variables, be it demographics, be it new technologies, be it that while the discount rate is a critical input into valuation and forward expectations, there are other conditions that you need to keep in mind, namely the quality of business, how much do they compound capital, and how does that compare relative to opportunity costs? What other businesses can institutions put their money in? And there may not be a lot of high-quality businesses that compound at a certain level, so that may raise their multiple because of supply and demand in a higher interest rate environment. So I would just not extrapolate the view of a person that does fixed income into equity markets, or a global macro trader that makes a lot of money once every 10 years, they do triple digits. And then, you know, the next 10 years, they underperform and then they make triple digits. So like, if you're with them for 20 years, your IRR is probably a little bit better than the S&P 500. But it's long waits and pops. If I were a fixed income investor, this would be my ideal outlook, right? You know, so that this would be my bias. My bias would be rates will remain elevated, capital availability will be more constrained. Every time there's any hiccup in the market, all these guys come on, and you know them, very successful fixed income investors. They're saying this is going to be there's going to be a lot of defaults, blah, blah, blah. Why? Because they have a lot of powder that they haven't been able to put to work for 10 years. And they keep praying to God that they're actually going to get a dislocation period like 2009, where they can put a lot of money to work. And they haven't gotten it. They didn't even get it during the pandemic lows. So that's not to say it won't happen in the future. And it certainly could and potentially will. But just, you know, I invite you to don't ask your barber if you need a haircut. Okay, I've lost my camera and I don't know how to get it back in. So, all right, you'll just have to go the rest of the video without seeing me, which I'm sure many of you are happy about, and I don't blame you. Kayla Smith, Hi, Tom. What are your thoughts on UNG natural gas? It looks absolutely left for dead, very cheap. I watched a few podcasts and video casts and remember a natural gas company you invested in the past. It turned out to be a multi-bagger. We still own it. Surely it can't be that simple. Am I missing something? Yes. The UNG has roll yield, negative roll yield. So it's just going to keep going lower because when they roll out to the next contract, they get negative yield. So you can just see here, even when natural gas goes up, it doesn't tend to work. If you want exposure to natural gas, the two best companies that I would be interested in, I mean, it's up, you know, 6.5x from our basis, but it's still cheap, is Range Resources and Comstock Resources, which is Jerry Jones, the guy who owns the Cowboys. I think this is probably a better trade. And then Southwest, but their balance sheet's not as good, so you really got to believe in it. But I'd probably, if I had to put money to work in natural gas, I'd probably get a little Comstock and a little Range, which we have. Next, Stephen Frampton, wondering about your thoughts on Dream Unlimited Corp. DRM. It's a Canadian real estate conglomerate whose CEO has compounded equity at 20% since the 90s. Despite being pretty diversified, it owns a lot of offices on Bay Street, the Wall Street of Canada. Has also sold off pretty heavily, as trading at 0.65 times book, or trading at 65% of book, and something like half of NAV. Reminds me a lot of Vornado with the experienced CEO and quality assets, but extreme discount. I got one of my friends to listen to your podcast. Now he won't stop saying opinion follows trend. Thanks for your time. I really appreciate it. Steven. Okay, let's take a look at this. I'm not familiar with it. DRM. Okay, .to. Let's see. Wow, they really did leave my face over there. Okay, that's fine. .to. All right. So it's off about 50%. Whereas Bonato is off 75%. Let's see here. DRM. I'm probably not going to be extremely helpful with this one just because I don't know the assets as well as I know the assets in, with Vornado. I mean, Vornado, I go in their buildings. I go in their buildings for meetings or for TV. Like I know what assets they own and where they are. And I know that if demand drops to 50% for the best buildings in the best city in the world, we're all effed. So I'm willing to bet that we're not all effed. And even though it's pricing in that we're all effed, it's usually a little bit better than people expect. And with this one, the other thing that I'm not comfortable with is I don't know how the financing works in Canada. Like, I think it's like, isn't it variable or the mortgages are done every 5 years? I'm sure commercial is a little bit different, but I don't know enough to really be helpful to you, to be honest with you, for Canadian real estate. This is a world that I've never played in. But I think you just got to look at the buildings one by one, as we did with Vornado. Vornado, if you go to Investor Relations, they have the whole book and you can see what you own. I'd probably want to see that, you know, comparing Bay Street to Manhattan is like apples and oranges. Like I can't be sure Bay Street's going to be the center of the world for Canada. I mean, I don't know, it probably will be, but it looks like it just had a monster run off the pandemic lows. It's done a little retrace. I mean, Vornado, it's trading back to great financial crisis lows. Like, I don't have to really think a lot about it. This one, I got to think too much. I don't think there's enough margin of safety just looking at it. Like, I'm not comfortable in the commercial real estate environment, as bad as it might get, to have this that's only done a little bit of a retracement. I'm inclined to say pass. even without having extensive enough knowledge that I would need to have to make an educated decision on this, just from my instinct is it's just hang out with that. I would just pass. There's always new opportunities. Here is from Oliver Larson. Thank you for your insightful podcasts. They are joy. Sadly, I don't have anyone to share it with since I'm pretty alone about investing among my people. He's from Denmark. Okay, that makes sense. I never got to make contacts in the industry as I started my own fund while attending university, never getting to work with other people, although things are going just fine. My question, instead of waiting for Alibaba to realize a target price, why not just hold on to it for many, many years? As Alibaba and subsidies are in attractive markets, which seem to be poised for growth for many, many years, and let it compound beyond the target price. It seems as if there is the possibility to get a favorable CAGR over the next 10 plus years from this investment. I know I will be holding, but I'd love to hear if you have an opinion to the contrary. The reason I will not be holding for 10 years is because emerging markets run cyclically in line with the US dollar. So there's no durability to an emerging markets trade for the most part. And the dollar runs in cycles. And when that cycle is over, no matter how great the businesses are performing, the equity prices are going to be toasted. So I'm going to be in this thing for another 24 to 36 months, maybe 48 months. It's going to reach my estimate of combined fair value, and I'm going to be out. And probably at that point, China will be done like Japan. And I know everyone thinks that's silly season, but their one child policy, they're toast. So at that point, based on kind of where India is, probably all the China profits I'll be plowing into India at that stage. India is a little too young right now and still needs to develop some aspects of infrastructure, rule of law. Their population needs to get a little bit older into that early 30s range, the bulk of their population where the sweet spot is, and then we'll ride that for another 5+ years. So that's why. And, you know, if it was a US company like Amazon, I don't have currency, major currency risk, and it doesn't work cyclically like emerging markets always have, I would say you're right. But that's just not the way it works. So there's the practical world and the idealist world, and the practical world is where you make money. I trust all as well. Wanted to know your perspective on Pfizer. Oh, this is from Sumit. Sumit's a good follow because on Twitter, because he takes all of the articles that I post every morning and he goes into them and then he cuts out paragraphs from them and highlights important points and posts them on his Twitter. So if you don't have time to read all the articles I post, he kind of does the summaries that are specific for China and for Alibaba. So check that out. He does good work. Pfizer's increased its revenue. I mean, I'll go through it real quick, but I agree with you. I think Pfizer's fine. We have enough exposure to biotech that we don't need anymore, but I think Pfizer's more of a trade. It's going to be, you know, they have patent cliffs. They're, you know, that's why they're desperately trying to buy the growth with Seagen, with Biohaven. They're going to have to do a lot of deals, and it takes time to get the synergies and to get all those cylinders firing. But I think you're good for a trade here for 20%. But anyway, Pfizer's increased its revenue and free cash flow significantly in the last 2 years thanks to COVID. But with the bulk of vaccinations now in the rearview mirror and other patent cliffs, its growth on the surface seems shaky. Its recent announcement of Seagen, all cash transaction, will burden it, a lot of debt, net debt of $12 billion. Wonder if the stock trades at price to free cash flow of 9.1. No one. Okay. Oh, wanted to know your perspective on Pfizer. All right, so I'm not that interested in it, but I think it's fine for a trade at best. Let's take a look here. I mean, looking backwards is not really going to help because they've got so many acquisitions coming in and their capital structure is going to change from all the new financing. But yeah, I think it's like Novartis. I think it's just going to be a sleepy grower. You're not going to lose money. You're not going to make a ton of money. You'll get a dividend along the way. They'll do some acquisitions. Um, And that's that. I think Pfizer is nothing more than a trade. There's so many more ways to make money. And I think based on the tenor of your Ask Me Anything question, you agree with that conclusion. So it'll work as a trade. I just think it's too slow of money. Like there's no major catalyst that makes me think this thing's going to revert back to some intrinsic value or some game changer that's going to yeah, drug companies are always tricky. That's why I buy them mostly in baskets with some exceptions, but that's how to play that sector. So with that said, I want to thank everyone for tuning in live from New York City. We'll be back next week, same time, probably different place, probably Connecticut next week. But in the meantime, make it a great one. Bye for now.